welcome again. I'm broadcasting from Oakland, where it is sunny after we've had a good week's worth of heavy, heavy downpour rain. Actually, it hailed yesterday, and I'm not sure if any of you are aware, but California is going through one of its worst droughts in, I think, a decade, if not longer. We have severe water shortage in all of the regions, and whenever we get rain right now, it's like, fantastic, more rain. So, but today it's beautiful. As I look out my window, it's a perfect day. Lots of news with Earth Ancients, before we present our main focal point today, which is fascinating, I wanted to highlight a couple of bits of information. We have recently confirmed a guest coming up in a couple of weeks. He wrote a fascinating book called The Ancient Giants Who Ruled America, and his name is Richard Dewhurst. He'll be with us March 19th. The biggest bit of information that he's revealing, actually it's a huge piece of information, is, as I've suspected for a number of years, the Smithsonian has been taking information, taking archaeological finds, and burying them. And Dewhurst's book, The Ancient Giants Who Ruled America, actually highlights quite a bit of information, quite a bit of historical documents that show that not only are complete skeletal remains being taken and stored away by the Smithsonian, but complete archaeological sites with pottery shards, carvings. In one case, there's what some of the researchers have claimed are Rosetta Stones, to kind of give research investigators and scientists an idea of what the language was of these so-called giants. And I'm not really into the giant theory or the giant phenomenon, but his book basically says that shows that America was just populated by these gigantic people, some as tall as 12, 15 feet. So we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. The other area that is of interest to me that I have posted is a little bit about the findings in Mexico. And my primary interest in Mexico is the Maya. And as the archaeologists are digging, they're digging down and finding layers and layers and layers of earlier people. And you don't really read about this, because when they do that and they date those lower layers, those deeper layers, they're finding that it's pushing the inception period or the date of the Maya significantly further back, much further back than they would like to say. So I've posted quite a bit of information on that. Also, there is more information about my guest next week, Jim O'Conn, and his book. I've already posted on his water filtration discovery that the Mayas used an advanced microfiltration system to purify their water. And it looks like it may have been a system that is thousands and thousands of years older than what archaeologists are telling us. The funny thing about that also is I've spoken to him a number of times, and he's very unhappy with the archaeologists because they're unwilling to push the Mayas' beginnings further than a few thousand years ago. And we're going to speak to him directly next week, so look forward to that one. Definitely listen in on Jim O'Conn's presentation, and it should be fascinating. So I think it's important that I talk a little bit about myself. People are wondering, who's this Cliff Dunning guy, and why did he start Earth Ancients? I'm a native Californian, oldest of five brothers, and in my early, when I was a younger person, I had a very big interest in design, art, things like that. And so out of high school, I got a scholarship to Academy of Art College in San Francisco. And I was an illustration student for a number of years. I eventually was transferred to, Long Beach, where I completed a credential and was an illustrator for a long time. But right out of college, I was an art director for two magazines in the Silicon Valley. I ended up coming back up here. Los Angeles is so big, I was overwhelmed just at the sheer size of the place. And I used to joke with my friends, it's like Los Angeles is like an ant farm. It's so big. So anyhow, I came back up here. I was an art director for 4 or 5 years, two magazines. They're not around anymore. One was, strangely enough, it was called Military Science and Technology, and it had the latest research and development on armaments, specialized bombs and things like that. And the reason that it was in Santa Clara, California, is that that's the heart of the Silicon Valley. And that was the period where they were beginning to use GPS and other guidance systems in a sophisticated nature where they could create the early smart bombs. And so the publication was basically read by the military, the Congress, and the industry. So I think at the height of its development and publication, we had about, I want to say, 100,000 readers, maybe less. So after that, I worked for myself as a graphic designer, had a business, had a lot of clients in the industry, and but it really wasn't my calling. It wasn't something I was really interested in. And so I actually went to a small conference called Whole Life, and just off on a whim, and discovered that they were talking about Native American traditions, also archaeological finds and things like that. And I was curious, and I sat through the program from, I think, 8 a.m. all the way to the ending at 7 p.m., and was totally amazed at the information. I would eventually write a letter to the producer of the event and offered my service to him as somebody who could write a stronger program and bring, suggest speakers that may strengthen the program. And I was hired. He hired me as a associate producer. And so that began about a 7 to 8 year program development where I met people like Zachariah Sitchin, Graham Hancock, and a wide variety of authors who, we're talking 1995. And this was the beginning of a lot of awareness towards ancient cultures, ancient unknown cultures. And so that was fascinating. And I, continued my interest and was a voracious reader. But I worked with a lot of up-and-coming authors who now are well-known in the field. So that's a little bit about my background. I will say this also. My grandfather had a huge influence on me. My grandfather, Dr. Rudolf Gerber, who was a physician in Oceano, California, which is in central California, just south of San Luis Obispo. He was an influence on me because he was fascinated by Native Americans. And he was so fascinated that he filled a room, one of his rooms when his children left. He had three daughters. He filled it with Native American pottery and baskets and sculptures, and had a library of Native American writers and historians and things like that. And that was a huge influence on me. And so I really, I mean, he was a big influence in my life anyhow, but what he brought in terms of an interest also rubbed off on me. And some of the programs that I developed for a Whole Life Expo, Whole Life Expositions, were based on Native American traditions, and they were fun, and they were some of the largest attended events at the program. One of our speakers was a Native daykeeper from Yucatan, Mexico, a shaman priest named Humbats Men, and in that one program that he did, we had over 2,000 people in the audience. It was standing room only. So that's a little bit about me. And so I had initially planned to have our next guest on the program to discuss his book, Seeds of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty. The author is John Burke, and he was co-presented by Kai Halberg. But I just found out a week ago that John Burke passed away in 2010, 4 years ago. And I was shocked because I've been looking at the book and studying his work, and it's fascinating. He actually uses electronic sensing devices to measure energy emitted not only from the Earth, but from pyramids, sacred sites, and he has written some profound material about the use of these pyramids and what he believes the natives actually created them for. So I actually found a couple of different presentations he did in 2006, and we're going to listen to this first introduction that he gives at a conference, and we'll get a little background. So here's an introduction to a conference features John Burke.
I'm really a New York businessman with a scientific background. This is an avocation for me, and certainly not a profession. But fortunately, the business that I was working in back in 1993 involved using very low-energy electron showers, in other words, very low-energy electromagnetic forces, to treat agricultural seeds. And the result was dramatic improvements that have been verified several hundred times by third parties like universities and seed companies and whatnot. So I was lucky to be in that frame of mind when in 1993, myself and my co-author, Kai Halberg, stumbled into a situation at Avebury Henge in England, which is sort of the grandfather, the godfather of Stonehenge, where it looked like maybe something similar was going on here. And we spent the next 3 weeks doing 1,000 measurements to confirm that, and we'll get to that a little bit later. But the point is, it started us off on a quest that's been ongoing ever since, to go to one location after another. And so far, we've measured over 80 sites personally using standard scientific instruments. Because one thing I wanted to make sure was that this was something that could be accepted by the scientific field in general, because they're standard instruments that anybody can use. And the forces are still there, and you can go back and confirm them. So what we are talking about is this certain set of coincidences, if that's what you want to be skeptical and call them, that throughout the world, whatever we've been able to find, with only a couple of exceptions out of those 80, overwhelmingly, the architects of megalithic structures, henges, pyramids, you name it, chose to site their buildings directly on top of a certain very special type of geology that dramatically amplifies the normal electromagnetic fluctuations that take place on the Earth every day. And that's the Earth that is the engine that drives all this. But they knew how to spot these spots where there was this special geology, and then they would design and then build out of materials that would further concentrate these energies several 100%. And the interesting part is, coming from the state of mind that I was, it occurred to me, could they have been doing it in order to increase food production? Because that's what we were able to do with similar types of energies.
So, with his background as a scientist and a business owner, he had been using magnetic frequencies and directing those frequencies onto seeds to get them to produce better crops. And out of curiosity, it seems that he decided that he was going to start testing some of these ancient sites and pyramids. And we're going to hear in a minute what he discovered at some of the pyramids and the equipment he used. But what's fascinating about this is that this is something I've thought about just off the top of my head for the last decade, and that's why it saddens me that Burke isn't with us anymore, because this is groundbreaking research. Now, the natives that I have talked to in Yucatan, the Mayan elders, specifically Humboldt's men, who is a mentor and teacher of mine, has always discussed and said that the pyramids were built over sacred earth areas that are emitting frequencies, not just lightly, but in such a powerful way that the energy comes up through the ground and is amplified by the stone structures. And that's why a lot of ceremonies were done on the pyramids. What we don't know is the science behind that. And this is what Burke is beginning to show us in his book, using the equipment he uses. And we're going to hear just a short clip on the actual equipment and what the readings would show. So here's a further excerpt from this presentation John Burke presented.
What we did was take some standard scientific instruments to these sites, and they included a fluxgate magnetometer measuring the magnetic changes in each spot. And these changes that I'm going to talk about here take place everywhere on the Earth every day. The next one was an electrostatic voltmeter, which measures the electrification of the air or a stone that might be electrified. And the third was these special geological type electrodes that are used by the USGS that you simply stick in the ground, you connect by maybe 100 feet of wire, you get a voltmeter in the middle there, and it will measure these natural telluric currents that are simply natural electric currents running through the ground. Okay. Now, the engine for all this is the Earth's magnetic field. And essentially every day, the strength of the Earth's magnetic field strengthens because of its interaction with the solar wind. Then it drops off at night and gets much weaker. Everywhere, every day, you know, your backyard, your bedroom, every spot on the Earth. Certain of these geologies will concentrate that, but we all experience this. Then what happens is, in the pre-dawn hours, the few hours right before dawn, the geomagnetic field in every spot comes rushing back to closer to full strength very quickly in the few hours before dawn. It's the most dramatic time of the day for that type of change. And that means if you want to study this, you have to be out in the field at 3 a.m., which is not the most pleasant passion, but that is what generates a thing called a process, a physical principle that's called induction. Whenever you have a fluctuating magnetic field anywhere, it's simple physics, induction, that it also generates an electrical current in anything present that will conduct electricity. That's actually how our power plants are run and how we get the lights we have here. Is the power plants that we have to put energy into are basically just moving a giant electromagnet past a giant amount of copper wiring and generating an electric field every time that change happens that runs through the wires that becomes the lifeblood of our industrial civilization. So there's nothing mysterious about this. There's nothing esoteric. It's very well-known principles. But we began to find that in certain spots where these megaliths were, these forces, these daily forces, were much more powerful, several times more powerful, and that had some dramatic results, as you're going to see here.
One of the things that the book does highlight, the book again is Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty, is that not only do the pyramids that he analyzed, Chichen Itza, the pyramid there was the El Castillo. He went to a number of other areas throughout Maya. He went to Uxmal and measured the pyramid there, the pyramid of the magician. But what he discovered and what is fascinating is not only does the energy get amplified by hundreds, if not thousands of times stronger, is that there's a period when you're in the pyramid where at a certain time of day, it is actually can change the chemistry of your body. And this is a fascinating revelation because these pyramids must have been used for a wide variety of applications other than just seed enhancement, which is what John's interest was, enhancing seeds so they had the better yield. Now, he downplays, he calls it the esoteric aspect of the pyramids. I started visiting Yucatan and the Mayan pyramids in 1995, and the first time I went to Chichen Itza was, I had no idea. I had been told by my friend Humban Spin, the Mayan priest, that these were sacred sites and that there was a lot of unseen energy at play. Well, the first time I actually climbed on El Castillo in 1995, and actually they don't allow you to go inside or climb on them anymore, which is really sad, but I climbed to the very top, and when I went to through the small room and I looked out, I was hit with some kind of a blast of, and by the way, this is like 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I was hit by a blast of what felt like wind, but I noticed that my feet were buzzing. And I was like, what just happened to me? And I actually was disoriented to the point where I had to stand and stay in that room for about 45 minutes to an hour before I could descend down the staircase. And I didn't really realize what had happened to me until I spoke to Humbats, and he told me that I had picked up on a vibrational stream or an energy stream. And so when John says that, and this is one of the things I have a little bit of an issue with in his book, in that the pyramids were built specifically for food propagation. In other words, putting seeds and other grains and things in the pyramid to enhance them. I believe that the pyramids, and I've been told, and the tradition of the Maya is that they were used for human enhancement, as well as to cleanse the area, cleanse the atmosphere. So John, I believe his book is wonderful, and I'm actually strongly urge you to get it if you have any interest at all in pyramids as machines. But, you know, in a way, we use the term machines, but they're actually earth enhancers. Gravitational enhancers. And I so happened to find a brief overview of how the pyramids function by my mentor, Humbert Smin. I'm going to play it for you in a second here. It's very short, but it gives the native perspective on the pyramids. And let me just find this cut here real quick. Here it is. So I'm going to play this cut. Now, about, I think, 4 years ago, there was a photograph taken of two children standing in front of El Castillo. And in the photograph, we see the pyramid, but rising out of the top of the pyramid is a beam. And a number of people have said this beam is light refracting off the lens of the camera, so forth and so on. But what those people don't understand is that there was no way that these local people, actually they came from Mexico City on vacation, could have manipulated the image. They don't have the ability or the software to do so. But Humbots is going to explain to us in this shortcut what that is, and also he's going to talk a little bit about the pyramids. So here is this cut from a talk that he gave. Now, his English is not good, so you're going to have to listen very closely. English is his second language. So here's the cut.
May you comment on the beams of light coming out of Chichen Itza and the Bosnian pyramids that were captured in the photo?
Ah, the light appear like this. Almost the diameter is like from there to here. Yeah? The diameter of the light. Yes, the light came like this. But the diameter of the light is maybe from here to here. We have in our Mesoamerica around 21,000 ceremonial centers. Each ceremonial center have a huge pyramid like Chichen Itza in Chichen Itza, Teotihuacan in Teotihuacan, the Pyramid of the Sun. Something maybe later they're going to discover, or maybe the NASA begin to discover something they're going to mention. The NASA of the United States, they went to Chichen Itza to establish some machines for to understand how it works, that energy. Because in Chichen Itza, the lighting, we understand the lighting comes like this, zook, zook, you know? Thunder and lightning, zook, zook. They discovered in Chichen Itza, in that pyramid, the light or the thunder lighting traveled horizontal. Okay, but the light there, I have the picture too, is each pyramid have the way how it works with the energy. So, can you imagine it? 21,000 pyramids. Before the Spanish come to Mexico, and people in that time can do ceremonies. Can you imagine it? How many things they did with the energy. Like I mentioned to you, in the 95, we did a huge ceremonies in Chichen Itza. And in that year, begin to manifest the indigo children. Maybe because the work we did, because maybe...
Okay, so I'm going to clarify a few things he said. So I've known him, Humbats, for a number of years, and I've been down to Yucatan about... I've spent summers there in the jungles with him. I've probably been down there over a dozen times. And each time I go down, I'm totally blown away and fascinated. It's just overwhelming. But one of the things he says to me, and he's always says the same thing, is there's 21,000 ceremonial centers throughout Yucatan, which go all the way down to Belize. 21,000. So, and when I ask him, well, where are they? He says they're buried. And at first I thought, well, you know, how could they be buried? That just is no way. There's just too many. But the more I began to investigate the Yucatan Peninsula, I discovered that the entire area was covered underwater for years, and it basically pushed down the whatever buildings and cities that were on that peninsula, it flattened them. And I actually have shown photographs of Sahil and parts of Uxmal. What most people don't understand is that these ruins, even Chichen Itza, they're only been partially excavated. They're only fraction, maybe 5-10% at the most of the entire city. Those cities are excavated completely, and so there's huge sections that are underground that have to be excavated. It's a very expensive process, and the Mexican government just doesn't have the resources. But 21,000 ceremonial centers. So, and then that's what he says in this short clip. Then he goes on to say that NASA has been researching not only Chichen Itza's pyramid, but the other pyramids to determine the energy flow. And because people walk around those that pyramid and around some of those other buildings, and they can, you know, feel the magnetic force or an energy coming up and coming out of those buildings. So, of course, we don't know what NASA has ended up. I have not found any research documents from NASA, so who knows where that information went. So then Humbats goes on to say that those ceremonial centers were used for a variety of applications, and that they're still very active today, even though they're buried. And the last thing he says, which I find is fascinating, is recently he has detected a tremendous increase in energy and the emergence of what he calls the indigo children. And if you don't know what indigo children are, those are these kids that have the ability to see energy, to perceive other dimensions. There's a lot that's being written about these indigo kids, and they're a different level of human. They look like us, but they're just highly attuned to a lot of unseen forces. They're very, very intuitive. I don't know a lot about them, except that what I've read is in some cases they can go back and look at their life before they actually became physical. So very, 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 very interesting type of human. So that's the native perspective of the people who are the whose ancestors built those pyramids and sacred cities. So I was hopefully you're able to grasp some of the things he said. We're going to have Humbots on the program probably this summer or maybe in the fall, and ask him a few questions about what's going on. I also plan to make a couple of broadcast a couple of programs from the Yucatan and from Lima, Peru, where some of those pyramids are beginning to seems like they're beginning to grow in activation. So John Burke's work is groundbreaking, and I don't want to belittle him. I really find that his discovery is significant, and it's something that I'm going to take and move forward with. And the next, in fact, all future trips that I take to the Yucatan, I plan to purchase and do some of my own testing while I'm down there to see actually the levels of energy that is emitted from not only the pyramid, but some of these other buildings. One thing that I haven't discussed that I do write about on the Facebook page is the fact that my belief is that the Maya, and actually there's some writings about it, the Maya are descendants from a group of earlier people who settled the Yucatan Peninsula. And those earlier people were highly advanced, highly sophisticated, and they were technologists. Our guest next week, Jim O'Conn, actually talks about an article that he read in a Spanish chronicler, who actually documented that he was present in a room that was filled with scientific books and manuals from the Maya. And this is before those volumes were burned. And it's always been my feeling that the Maya, what we see, these loincloth-wearing people, were the survivors of a cataclysmic event that pretty much wiped the majority of the civilizations of Earth off the planet. And those who survived had to regroup. And this is why when you go to Yucatan, you see these ruins. You can see that they're archaeologically sophisticated. There's a lot of math and geometry and a very high level of civil engineering. And this is what Jim O'Conn found, and we'll talk about that again next week with him and his book. But these are not simple piles of rock. These are not simple carved civic centers. These are well planned out, massively designed and placed complexes. And these are probably significantly older than we understand. I mean, presenting this in a number of articles and also in a book, Earth Ancients. I have a chapter in Earth Ancients that discusses this. And then I have a future book that I will present that actually shows these buildings that are covered. So there's a history, there's a lost history that is slowly emerging. And you won't read about it by traditional archaeologists because, first of all, they don't know what they're looking at. They're just digging it out. And secondly, they have a problem with dates that are earlier than what they've been trained to understand is the date for the inception of the Maya, you know, a few thousand years ago. And a lot of archaeo investigators like myself are engineers, people who study building techniques and study Oh, by the way, Jim O'Conn is a structural engineer, and we'll let him discuss what he found. But there's a lot that's not being brought to the public's attention, it's really a shame, and it's really it's not. I think people intuitively know that it's not what the story is about, and so that's something to look forward to. So, John Burke, I would suggest getting his book, Seeds of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty, reading it. It's a great read. It was co-written by Kai Halberg, but Kai was the photographer. They both would go out there. John is the technologist. He's, like I said, he is the author and the writer of the book, and Kai was the photographer of the sites and also helped with a lot of the testing. So get that book. Okay, so that is probably it for our program today. Let me just take a quick look here and make sure. Again, next week is James or Jim O'Conn. The following week is Richard Dewhurst, and he will be presenting information from his book, The Ancient Giants Who Ruled America. And as a subtext, he writes, and the book's completely filled with these amazing skeletons. Subtext is The Missing Skeletons of the Great Smithsonian Cover-Up. And by the way, there's a section in here under Sophisticated Cultures of the Ancient Giants, where he shows a photograph of a stone duck bowl. And this bowl must have been crafted in some kind of a piece of machinery, because it's stone that was cut, similar to some of those Egyptian bowls that you see in Cairo, the Cairo Museum. But this stone duck bowl was found in Moundville, I think it's South Carolina. And it's fascinating that the entire book is based on the United States. He doesn't go outside the U.S. All these mounds, all these giants, are found in America. And the first part of the book basically discusses the East Coast, the mound builders of the East Coast, and some of the megaliths there. And then he goes all the way to the West Coast and the Catalina Islands, where there's a number of burial sites where these giants are found. And most of the reporting that he finds is before the knowledge filtration started going on. What's knowledge filtration? If you remember correctly, Michael Cremo, in his discussion with us last week, and 2 weeks ago, and excerpts from his book, he believes that scientific community is filtering the information that they discovered. If it doesn't fall within a certain paradigm, a certain logic that they have created, then it's filtered out. And so in his book, Dewar's book, The Ancient Giants Who Ruled America, all the information in here would be filtered. And so what you're getting here is information that is pretty mind-blowing because we're talking about people that are 7 to 9 to 10 feet tall, and built these huge mounds, but they also, what he found was they also built sophisticated cities, temples, and structures that are of stone. So that should be interesting. That's He's going to be here on the 19th, which is in a couple of weeks. So, as always, check the website, Facebook. Also remember that you can hear this on iTunes. So if you're in the car, you can punch into iTunes and dial it up, and it will be available. If you have any questions for me, any suggestions, you can email me at cdunning, C and then D-U-N-N-I-N-G, at gmail.com. And I'm going to start allowing people to ask questions. So if you want to call in, you can dial 347-826-9565, and I will see you there. And you just press the number 1, and you can get onto the program and speak directly to my guest. So be well, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.